All right, welcome to episode 6 of Defrag. I'm here with my good man, Gove. Gove, how are you? You got new glasses.
I do. I can finally see again without making it seem like I'm hiding from people.
Awesome. Awesome. Great. All right, so we'll dig in. The first thing I wanted to do was mention a post that I missed. It was from a couple of weeks ago, and I had this post that I wanted to mention, if you can bring that up.
Sure.
It's from Windows7News.com. And it was a webcast for advanced Windows 7 troubleshooting. So it's a four-parter, and if you do much Windows 7 troubleshooting, you probably want to take a look at this. So we'll put a link in the show notes, and you can click over and check this out. So it's from Mike Halsley. So great thing to watch there, something to keep you busy in your free time, if you actually have any free time. So, first problem of the week we want to talk about, our own Nick Fillingham from Channel 9. He had a problem where he wrote us and he said, Outlook 14, 64-bit, is now crashing when I open specific emails on three separate machines, all Windows 7 64-bit. I can't see a pattern in the content of the email, some internal, some external, some sent to distribution lists, others just to me. His OST is pretty large, 7.6 gig. Come on, Nick. although Outlook is reporting they still have 773 meg free on his 4.5 gig Exchange allowance. Any service packs or updates installed, as far as he can tell, he's got them all installed. Any ideas? And we actually fixed this one, so walk us through what we went through here to help Nick out.
So this was actually kind of a fun one. Whenever I hear about Outlook crashing on multiple machines, just by opening it, you know.
Yeah.
So the first thing that Outlook does is opens up the mailbox and it displays that first email that's there.
Yeah.
So those are always kind of like interesting to me.
And if your first email is a problem email,
yeah,
that's your biggest problem right there. Send yourself a new email for starters.
Right. So if you can send yourself an email and you know, do it from a different machine, get somebody else to do it, that's great. You know, it might get you into a mode that you can at least start up Outlook and figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
When it's happening on multiple machines, it usually tells me that there's a problem email of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to take a look at the crash dump. Nick sent it to me, and being able to debug it, I was able to get some additional data, you know, look through our archives, our bug archives,
yeah,
figure out what was going on. Even just through standard debugging, I was able to figure out that it was a font that he has installed on his computer. Now, Nick, he does a lot of artistic work, so he's got a lot of fonts installed on the system, and they can come from pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a, you know, just a general warning to folks. You know, fonts are very integral parts of your system. You know,
yeah,
it's how UI is displayed on your system, and depending on how the fonts get on your system or what types of fonts they are, they can change the way that the system reacts very subtly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's oftentimes very difficult to get back to a state where, you know, that font isn't there, being able to uninstall that font,
yeah,
depending how
so
it even got installed.
If you did like a system restore, will that take out any fonts that you added since that?
It would, yes,
yeah,
but you would also have to have a system restore point that,
yeah,
that saved that state. You,
yeah,
know, he may have installed that font months ago, who,
mm-hmm,
knows?
Mm-hmm.
And it just happened to be this particular bug that triggered Outlook to crash. So anyways, with a bit of digging, I was able to find a KB article that we have about Word crashing. In this case, it was Word, but it's the same effect in Outlook. And basically, it just tells you how to remove the font, or in this case, how to substitute the font so that you can, again, keep going. You know, the first step is to substitute it with an OpenType font. You can set a different printer as a default. So what happens when you have a default printer set is that there is a set of fonts that it knows how to render in a particular way.
Yeah.
So every time you have a new default printer set, there's different mappings that are brought in so that it can optimize to the printer. So you can sometimes get out of this mess by switching to a different printer, so when something renders to the screen, it uses a different font substitution. And the other one is actually just remove the font from the document. If you can get to the mail or you can get to the document, in this case it had to do with Word,
yeah,
you can change the font out. In all of these cases, however, none of that worked. So what I had to do was actually go into his machine and physically remove the font from his system, and then he was finally able to get back and working.
So a couple questions about fonts. One, I remember long ago when I used to do a lot of design stuff, I had a machine that I had a lot of fonts on. I'm talking maybe even 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember I had some problems, some perf problems with that machine, and mm-hmm. I always kind of wondered if it was because of all the fonts that I had installed. Is that a bad idea to install that many fonts on a machine?
The number of fonts on your system does affect perf mm-hmm. because it has to enumerate those fonts and figure out, based on font substitution, which one it should swap in.
Yeah.
But in order to figure that out, it still has to enumerate everything. Fonts also take up, depending on the type of font that it is, will take up resident memory every time the system starts up.
Mm-hmm.
So it enumerates and says, I need to map these fonts into memory, and they never go away.
So the 50,000 versions of Wingdings I have, it probably wouldn't hurt for me to go through and clean out my system and
exactly.
take out all the weird fonts that I'm not using. So the other side of that, too, is are there such things as better fonts or fonts that are really bad? So, like, can I download a font that can really screw up my system, and should I be cautious of where I get my fonts?
You should always be cautious of where you get your fonts. I mean, they don't contain executable code or anything
yeah.
like that, but they can cause subtle issues with the system. You know, if they're slightly out of spec, the system might have to do a little bit more extra work in order to make sure that the font is sanitized.
Yeah.
But, you know, I saw this problem much more often on Windows 2000, 9X, XP even.
Mm-hmm.
As Vista Windows 7 came along, the system fonts that are included are actually really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
I would find it relatively difficult to believe that you need a ton of extra fonts.
Yeah.
Unless you're in design work.
You yeah.
know, if you're in design work, then, you know, get the Adobe type fonts.
Yeah.
And, you know, you load the specific set that you need on your system, and then you stick with those.
It's all about Calibri anymore anyway, kids. Come on. Let's get with it. All right. So next issue. We've got someone who wrote us who has an i5 laptop that they installed the wrong Windows 7 CD. So they installed 32-bit instead mm-hmm. of 64-bit. And they're wondering, do I really need to go back and format everything and go to 64-bit? Or is 32-bit going to be okay for them? Your first question was,
how much RAM?
How much RAM? So that was a big thing, and that's one of the things that they didn't let us know that we're waiting for a response back on. But the amount of RAM is going to make a difference because?
If you have more than 4 gig and you have 32-bit installed, you're not taking advantage of your memory.
All right, so let's say we've got a 4 gig laptop, so a typical laptop,
mm-hmm.
And you've got 32-bit Windows 7 on it.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any huge benefits that would make you want to flatten that machine to put a 64-bit operating system on it?
If I had native 64-bit software that I wanted to take advantage of, there are, you know, a couple of games or a few games out there that are native 64-bit, so, you know, they...
Security?
Security is another one, Patch Guard that's native to 64-bit.
Yeah.
ASLR is going to be more effective on 64-bit, the driver signing enforcement, all that kind of stuff.
Is there anything with the hardware itself, the processor, anything like that, that you're going to get huge benefits from that you might want to really consider flattening your machine?
I wouldn't say that it would be noticeable.
And if someone does need to go to 64-bit from 32-bit, what's the best way to do that and retain all your files?
Windows Easy Transfer is the best method. It comes on the DVD, and it'll save off your user data. Hopefully, you know, in this particular case, if you just installed it, you shouldn't have to worry about flattening the machine again. You
yeah.
know, nowadays, especially on current hardware, the Windows setup takes like 20 minutes tops.
Yeah.
So I have no qualms about flattening a machine.
Excellent. All right, so next question here was someone who has a SSD, a solid-state drive, on a machine.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing a trying to copy 2 gig from one part of the SSD to another part of the SSD and getting very slow transfer rates, around 5 to 8 meg per second. Is this normal, and how can they tell, and what things can they do to make sure that they're getting the fastest speed they can from their SSD?
So what they'd want to do is check for any firmware updates for
First of all, instead of
Yeah, so instead of copying the file, if they can at all get away with it, just move the file, because that just changes the some bits in the file structure itself.
Change where it points to, so it's a quick way to do that.
So if you don't have to copy at all, that is the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
If you do have to copy, then... I've noticed this as well on slower drives, copying to the same volume, same drive, is actually relatively slow. It'd be interesting to see what kind of speed they get copying to like a USB drive and then back.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to check, you know, their virus scanner, things that might be slowing it down just in general.
And trim?
Trim, you can... In case your SSD hasn't been set for trim support, it just notifies the OS that it doesn't mark certain bits as dirty. I can show
and
you.
And for people who don't know what trim is, can you explain a little bit about that and why it's important?
Right. So trim is a command that tells the SSD that blocks of data aren't considered in use and can be wiped internally, so the OS doesn't have to do it. It is not necessarily, you know, a huge perf improvement. It's just more of a reliability improvement.
And not every SSD will support trim, correct?
Right.
And how would you know if you've already got an SSD in a laptop that you've bought if it supports trim or not?
That is a very good question. You can use certain performance disk benchmarks. There was one that you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah, so there's an internal distribution list at Microsoft Hardware Junkies, and someone had this problem, and they were talking about, you know, my SSD's kind of slow. Could you run this benchmark? I think they're using the Crystal Mark or something that effect. Let me look it up here. Yeah, crystalmark.info.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were each posting what speeds they're getting with their particular configuration. And the thing that I noticed is it's not just your SSD. I mean, it's the interface that connects to on your system. In my case, a lot of times when I'm using a solid-state drive, I'm using a USB 3 connection. Mm-hmm. Some people might have RAID, and RAIDs, you know, vary widely depending on whether you've got a dedicated card to support your RAID or, you know, different ways that you've got set up. So there's a lot of things involved that go beyond just whether your SSD is fast or not.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other things that you could look for? I mean, drivers, I would imagine.
Yeah, drivers, BIOS updates. The other thing you can do if you wanted just a quick benchmark is run a WinSAT disk benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
And you just basically elevate a CMD window and... run WinSAT disk. And that just runs the disk assessment, the standard disk assessment. So I've actually got a 32 gig SSD in my system right now. I haven't done anything to perf improve it or anything like that, but we can take a look in about 60 seconds.
Okay. And when this runs, is it? Are you looking at the information that's on the screen, or are you saving it to a file that you look at later?
It can save to a file. There's another command for that.
That you can just look here and see.
You just look here. You can save it to an XML file, upload it for people, you know, to see if you've done perf improvement, if you've done any tweaks. People can, you know, share your knowledge.
Yeah. And what are you looking for here?
Well, as soon as the assessment is done, we'll take a look at what the random read, random write looks like, sequential read, sequential write speeds look like on this SSD, and I can point out different features of that.
Okay. We'll talk about our weekend until then.
What weekend?
Yeah.
I get to work this weekend.
Nice. Excellent.
I get to. Yeah, that's it. I'm looking
forward
to it.
You're very lucky.
I'm very lucky.
You're very fortunate.
Some other, so for SSDs, when you install your system, the OS knows if you're using Win7 that it should turn off disk defragmenting on the drive because it doesn't need
no
it.
No need to fragment the SSD.
Another
question, too, about RAIDs. If you were going to hook up an SSD in a home computer,
mm-hmm.
let's just say you've got motherboard, you've never really done a RAID,
mm-hmm.
do you suggest using the motherboard for the RAID controller, or do you suggest getting a card?
What are you going to use the RAID for?
Let's say I just want a very fast computer at home.
If you just want a very fast computer, or if you just want a faster computer than what it would be from hooking it up with a single drive system,
yeah,
you can use the motherboard controller. I mean, there's nothing wrong with using the motherboard controller.
Yeah.
It's nice that it's integrated. You don't have to spend any extra money.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's what I'm doing. I've got an Asus motherboard.
The Asus board is really good for their...
I've got four 750 gig, you know, platter drives on it that are, you know, RAID 5. So, you know, I always wonder, do I really need to get a RAID card?
RAID cards are nice because of their extra features.
Yeah.
That aren't there on the motherboard. You know, when you have the motherboard RAID controller, it's just a bare-bones RAID controller.
Yeah.
It's also taking memory away from the system, you know, a small portion of it to handle the RAID.
Yeah.
A dedicated card, you know, is just that. It takes all of that CPU, offload it onto the card. It can have battery backup, which is great for the sudden power loss or brownouts that can occur on a system. Anytime anybody has a RAID system, I highly recommend that they have a UPS system along with that.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you have multiple drives that are now acting as one, so the likelihood of something happening that could corrupt the data, and depending on what kind of RAID configuration you're using, you don't want to lose that data. You spent a fair amount of money setting that up. Spend $100, buy a UPS.
Yeah.
You know, save your system.
And what are some of the other benefits you get from having a RAID card that you wouldn't have from using the motherboard?
Just reliability. You know,
I hear people talk about, you know, they get such high speeds when they use an external card like that.
Yeah, I get a huge performance boost off of my system, and I'm using, you know, really semi-crappy 7200 RPM platter drives.
Yeah, same here. So, and a lot of these cards that I hear people saying, oh, you know, this is a great card and it's really fast, they're very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Should I even look at RAID cards if I'm going to go for a low-end one, or should I... What do you think is a decent amount of money to spend on a card?
There's some really nice mid-range cards. So I don't want to call them enterprise cards. I want to call them more professional cards.
Yeah.
And you can get some really nice ones for $300.
Yeah.
You know, and that would be about as low as I would go for a RAID controller card. Minimum, you know, 512 meg of RAM on the controller card itself.
Yeah.
And you get some very good performance. And it's a lot smoother, right?
Yeah. Excellent.
Oh, there it is.
All right, here we go.
You just have to threaten it.
Yes. Yeah.
we're going to go away. It's like, there it is. Okay. So, we actually have some relatively decent marks. This is a relatively older SSD.
Yeah.
This is a machine designed for Vista, so it's a good 4 or 5 years old now.
All right. And what are we looking for here? What are the important...
Everybody is going to look for the megabytes per second.
Yeah.
So sequential read, random read.
So 50 megasecond, that's not too bad?
It's not too bad.
Ends up working like theoretical speeds. So
no,
you can just get that out of your mind now.
Absolutely.
It's not going to happen.
And the things, you know, you'll just want to look for are the relative scores towards the...
And those are your typical WinSAT scores? They're scored 1 to 7.9?
Yes.
Excellent.
So, I mean, this is not a terrible system. Really good latency, or, you know, lack of latency.
Yeah, that's you get that from an SSD. Excellent.
6.9 for the read time with sequential writes.
Nice. Okay, so there you go. WinSAT space disk.
Yep.
Gives you that. Excellent. All right, next issue here. Let's go on to something you wanted to talk about, Windows Troubleshooting Platform.
Right. So this is a little-known piece that is built into the OS that are really good for IT shops. Your home user, if you want to, you know, explore more about your system and get more diagnostic information. Like, when you have weird things going on, you don't necessarily want to spend a lot of time digging through logs. But if you're seeing the same types of things across your machines,
yeah.
If you're always resetting one of the applications that you have installed, like let's say you have a less than stellar application that is a service,
mm-hmm.
and it communicates with your media center or something. So it's like some distributed application. You can use something called the Windows Troubleshooting Platform. What this is a set of XML files and PowerShell scripts that anybody can run on their machine that runs through a bunch of steps to give you additional information, to get you diagnostic information, reset to known good states. A lot of people may have actually used this before with the network troubleshoot problems.
Yeah.
So this is using the Windows troubleshooting platform. So you can have your own questions. You can distribute this thing to family members, for example. Let's say you're the main troubleshooting contact for your mom that lives across the country. You
yeah.
can't always go in and TS in, right?
Yeah.
A remote desktop. For...
Is the monitor on? That's going to be tough with this one.
That's going to be tough with this one. Look for the orange or green light. You know, yeah. If it's orange, it's in sleep mode. Wiggle
yeah.
the mouse. No, but what you can do is package up a whole bunch of tests, things that you would do on that person's machine
mm-hmm.
to get
and
them.
And can you actually run the tests, or are you just asking the questions, you know, have you run this test?
Oh, no. It will do all of that for you. It'll actually run those tests. So it'll ask you the question, and you can choose which one that you want to go through. It's like a
mm-hmm.
Workflow.
So you're telling it what application to run.
Yes. And I wanted to show the link for that. And if you just go to Bing and type in Windows Troubleshooting Platform, you'll find the MSDN page for it. I just want to go over it really quick. This troubleshooting pack is just a container of files and scripts, directives,
mm-hmm.
and the user can run it with their own privileges. You have to sign these troubleshooting packs, which is again very simple to do. It uses at its core Windows PowerShell, which is installed by default on all Win7 machines.
Yeah.
You can get reports, it can aggregate this, you can write events out to the event log, so...
So you can get the results of the applications that you've fired up?
Yes.
Excellent.
So this is the basic steps. You know, you have your metadata, you have your scripts, detection scripts, so this is the stuff that you would run to say, okay, I'm looking for the problems, you know, let it generate some data, and then based on the data you can run in resolution scripts to fix up whatever issue is there, then verification to see that the known states that you're looking for are actually present. You can run this for different locales, you know, people with different languages. And it's all very, very simple.
What level of simple is it? Is it like scripting? If you know HTML, you can do this, or is it like more dev level?
Oh no, I wouldn't call
IT
it dev.
Pro?
IT admins can definitely do this. Enthusiasts can do this.
Mid-level geeks.
Yeah. I mean, I picked this up in about a day.
Yeah.
So it's really not that, not that difficult. Especially it has samples. There are samples that you can extrapolate from.
And so now you have one for every family member.
Yes, you can have one for your mom, which basically formats your drive and reinstalls.
Excellent. All right.
You can have it run like spyware detection software if you
yeah.
wanted it to. You know, if there is very specific things, you can have it restore to a known restore point. Stuff that you can't always talk through with a person.
Yeah.
You can have this do it.
Wow. So you can have it like bring up a system restore point.
Yep.
Very cool.
Anything that you can script with PowerShell, you can script with this.
Very nice. Nice. All right, we'll put a link to this in the show notes.
Sure.
All right, and the last thing that I want to mention is we've got Zippy V in the Channel 9 forums, and he just sent us our log files, so you're going to look through those log files, and we'll get back to them next week.
I'll look over them over the weekend and see what I can find out from them.
Nice. You enjoy that weekend. I know you're going to have lots of fun.
Yes, pouring over logs in my dark office.
Excellent. That's episode 6 of Defrag. Thanks for watching.